and welcome to Dispel Magic, the podcast where we overthink how the magic of D&D might shape your campaign in surprising and unexpected ways. I'm Benjamin, game designer and writer.
My name's Dane. I'm a dungeon master, a podcaster, and a voice actor. Benjamin, do you hear electric guitars? I feel like an army of rock stars are on their way to break down our door.
It took me a minute to understand where you were going, because I thought you would say like bird song or a babbling brook, but I get it. Rockstar druids. I don't appreciate it, but I do understand it.
Rockstar druids. This is my favorite episode. About,
yeah.
We're doing the druid grove that I only heard about when you told us that we were going to do this spell.
Yeah, so we are talking today about a druid exclusive spell from Xanathar's Guide to Everything called Druid Grove.
Druid exclusive.
They don't get a lot of, well, I guess they get some exclusives, but they're usually not very sexy.
And not like this.
Not like this.
And not like this. Druid Grove. First time I've heard about it. First time I read this spell. I love the spell. My whole identity is this spell now.
Oh.
I'm going to build a whole campaign around this spell. That's not true.
Well, you might have been joking, but one thing I like about the spell, and we'll talk about it in a minute and explain what it does, but one thing that I like about the spell is that I feel like it was written more for DMs to explain why certain challenges might exist in a setting, because it's much more the kind of thing that you plan long term for, which is generally not something people playing D&D do as players. It's more like the NPCs in the setting are doing that,
right? Yeah, it's giving a mechanic to a cool cinematic atmospheric thing. But let's get into it so that people know what we're talking about.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about it, Dan?
Druid Grove is a 6th level abjuration spell available to druids. Only druids. It takes 10 minutes to cast, has a range of touch, and a duration of concentration up to 24 hours. The spell text says, you invoke the spirit of nature to protect an area outdoors or underground. The area can be as small as a 30-foot cube or as large as a 90-foot cube. Buildings and other structures are excluded from the affected area. If you cast the spell in the same area every day for a year, the spell lasts until dispelled. The spell creates the following effects within the area. When you cast the spell, you can specify creatures as friends who are immune to the effects. You can also specify a password that, when spoken aloud, makes the speaker immune to these effects. The entire warded area radiates magic. A dispel magic cast on the area, if successful, removes only one of the following effects, not the entire area. The spell's caster chooses which effect to end. Only when all its effects are gone is the spell dispelled. So, just kind of TLDR, you can make solid fog, which is fog that you can't see through and is hard to walk through. They've got grasping undergrowth, which is essentially an entangle spell, a perpetual entangle spell. You've got Grove Guardians, which is 4 awakened trees. You can also do additional spell effects. You can have a constant gust of wind in 2 locations of your choice. You can have spike growth in 1 location of your choice. You can have wind wall in 2 locations of your choice. Oh, 2 creatures immune to these effects. The winds are fragrant, gentle breezes, and the area of spike growth is harmless. Does a lot. It's a 6-level spell. It should do a lot.
It does a lot. What I really admire about the design of this spell is that I would love to have seen more high-level spells just be more like this, be more like world-building things rather than even more deadly combat.
Well, it's got a lot of intrinsic story hook kind of things.
Right.
They stumble into this place. They're grabbed by a bunch of trees. The Grove Guardians in the spell are said to have runes carved all over them, or show up, which is very cool to think about. So, you're grasped by a bunch of trees that are glowing. super cool. You find out the password to this place. You're able to go through. The fog lifts, right?
Right.
Just
yeah.
a lot of really fun things that you can play with.
When we're talking about expected uses for this spell, I think they're pretty straightforward. The first would be make a particular rural area difficult and dangerous to traverse. And I specify rural because it does say that these effects don't affect structures. So if you've got buildings there, the effects are null and void inside the building. And then the second expected use, which, like I mentioned at the top, is more for DMs than for players, is that it lets you create a kind of haunted forest or living, animate, self-defensive wilderness area by the book. In a lot of D&D's history, there's been this weird disconnect between player characters can have all these spells, but then there's also magic that exists in the setting, but that they can't do.
Yeah, just the BBEG can just
do a thing because
it's cool to do, but the players aren't able to do it themselves because there's no mechanics behind it. It's just flavor.
Exactly. So this feels like one of those spells that was written, you know, for either long-term campaigns where players are playing over the course, where action's taking place over the course of years instead of weeks or months. But then also as a way for DMs to point to something in the book and say, oh, well, this is how that NPC's fortress is going to function.
I can imagine this being cast on an area in a castle that has just like bare ground or like underneath, like as a safe house almost. Yeah. You have a cavern under your castle that you can retreat to that you've had this druid cast. You've got four cool mushroom trees down there that can just bust people up when they come in. A lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about that specifically, but that makes me think of how different this spell would function for what do you call non-subterranean dwelling humanoids?
People who terranian dwelling.
Yeah, so yeah, right. So yeah, I guess that's right.
Super terranian dwelling humanoids.
How different this spell works when you dwell on the surface versus subterranean. Like most of this episode we'll be talking about assuming that you live on the surface, but if you're a dwarf druid who knows this spell, it would make sense for there to be like your underground city, and then in the tunnels leading out you kind of pepper this spell around so that if your city's ever invaded, you've got plenty of like escape routes where there's a lot of kind of points of resistance for enemies that might be pursuing you.
They're like gate zones.
Yeah, gate zones. Anyway, dwarf considerations aside, let's get into... Dwarf fortresses aside, let's get into unexpected outcomes. So similar to a number of other spells that we like on this show, this one's duration changes to until dispelled if you cast it every day for a year. Most of the opportunities that we're going to be talking about in this episode are opened up by that kind of stipulation around it transitioning to until dispelled.
It's kind of hard for me to think about. There's so many other ways to secure yourself for 24 hours in Dungeons & Dragons using various other spells. This feels very specific. If you just want a grove for 24 hours, I guess. But maybe if you need the guardians to do something for 24 hours, that's
true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Physical, but it's helpful for me to conceptualize things in real life because what is 90 feet, right? Like that's hard to kind of think about, at least for me. So I looked up what 90 feet could be, and turns out a baseball diamond is 90 feet by 90 feet. So if you think about this in terms of a series of baseball diamonds, that might kind of help you wrap your head around what we're actually talking about.
And that's crazy because I would have guessed something more like 30 feet to like each base, but maybe I'm also thinking about like kids baseball versus baseball.
To be clear, professional baseball, the distance between first base and second base is 90 feet.
It's a lot of feet.
It's so many feet.
I understand now why they steal bases. I don't watch sports, guys.
We don't watch sports.
We read the Dungeon Master's Guide.
I haven't even played Blood Bowl. Oh, God.
So patient druids or druids with druid friends could quite easily create communities surrounded by effects like the effects of the spell to ward off intruders or assailants.
Or play baseball.
Actually, that's even better when you think about the four awakened trees that, like, what role do they play in the baseball game? I guess you've got, like, the catcher and, like, a baseman for each. So everybody else is playing outfield and... Or you do a second one for the outfield and then, like, nobody ever has to do anything except bat.
The fun part.
Yeah, the fun part. Exactly. Yeah. Like, you don't have to do any of the parts that, like, you groaned about doing when you were in elementary school and people made you play baseball.
I bet a tree would be a really good pitcher too, because, you know, the tension of the spring of the limb, right? Like rookie of the year.
It's funny that you say that, because I don't know why, but I was thinking about Rookie of the Year recently. There's probably like a sliver of the audience that's like of the age where they would understand what Rookie of the Year was and also are into D&D, but still know what Rookie of the Year is.
Everyone knows what Rookie of the Year is, okay? Everyone knows. Sound when he stretches his arm back and it's like...
Nobody under 30 knows what Rookie of the Year is, for sure. Anyway, speaking of people who are over 30 and thus ancient, Dane, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what features the druid class has that makes it even more likely that they have the time to be casting this spell a lot?
We all know that druids at high levels only age 1 year for 10 years. Everybody knows that. It's almost like we don't have to say it. I'm going to say it out loud, so that we're all on the same page about it. Everybody's seen Rookie of the Year. Everybody knows that 10 years equals 1 year for a high level druid, right? Okay.
Right.
Which is necessary if you're going to be stitching together a bunch of baseball diamond sized plots of land.
So I didn't do the math ahead of time. I should have. But let me think quickly.
You should never have to do math, Benjamin, especially you.
For this episode, I should definitely do math. But if we're thinking that a druid, let's say arbitrarily, is 40 by the time they unlock that feature that lets them age only 1 year for every 10 years that pass, that means as a human, assuming, what do you think is a safe lifespan assumption in D&D, Dane?
Well, for druids, probably a lot longer with the healing magic connection to nature.
Let's ignore that. I mean, kind of ignore that part.
75.
Okay. So 75 is how old humans live. So that's 35 years where they're aging half as fast. So that means that at the end of their life, a druid is going to be almost 400 years old. A human druid will be almost 400 years old. That's a lot of years to lay down interlocking or connected by edge sections of this spell.
Just doing some quick math here. Okay.
I promise you, listeners, that just as I did to figure out the equation of 35 times 10, Dane is for sure using a calculator app on his laptop right now.
Okay. So within the 24-hour period that Druid Grove is effective, you could watch Rookie of the Year 13.8 times.
Not the reason I thought he was accessing his calculator app, but okay.
Now, we like to talk about how different spells interact with the spell we're talking about here. We've talked about water breathing, right?
Yeah. So when we talked about water breathing, the thing I really honed in on, perhaps because of my own personal inclinations, is that this really sets druids up to be kind of community or cult leaders.
Did you just admit that you're a fascist? Is that what you just did?
I didn't say I was a fascist. I said that I think in a different life I could have been a cult leader, I think is the admission that I'm willing to make.
Okay.
And I don't know that that's terribly surprising to you, to the listeners it might be, but
at this point probably not to the listeners either.
Well,
Benjamin, hashtag spoilers.
Yeah, well, point is that lifespan of like a human, like being close to 400, it becomes easier to imagine that they've got plenty of time to carve out like a few decades to just wring whatever like lovely natural habitat they found in druid groves.
A mountain, a lake.
A valley, probably more likely.
Oh, yeah. A valley would be good.
I don't know why they'd want to seal off a mountain, but a valley seems like the kind of thing that they would want to protect.
This is our mountain. There are many like it, but this one is ours.
Right. Basically, what I'm getting at when I say a valley, not a mountain, is that if you're a druid who is, I guess, whose motivation for doing this is to attract a community or to build a community, you're probably looking for segments of wilderness that are particularly attractive. I can imagine there might be some people willing to follow you to a mountain, avid skiers, people who like to hike, I guess, or people who enjoy eating goat exclusively.
Only goat, but for me.
Oh,
from
just
now on.
Just a pure all goat diet. But more likely, I feel like what they're going to be focused on more are kind of particularly beautiful or
idyllic
tracts of land. And in addition to being able to, so the kind of like interaction point between Druid's Grove and other spells is that Druid's Grove forms a really good ring of protection around these areas. But then using spells like plant growth, create food and water, and water breathing, you can really enhance your ability to kind of build a community. Plant growth makes it so that you for sure will be able to grow a lot of food and quickly. Create food and water means that even if you're in a place that's inhospitable to growing food, you've still got food and water. And water breathing means that if this is you're traveling to an island or something, that's easy to do. You don't need to even build boats. You can just be casting water breathing and transporting people kind of through the sea to this whatever archipelago or whatever else you're trying to set up.
Break down the barriers between land and water. All is our domain. We're druids.
We're with you.
Right.
Whenever you're building a community, you're going to have families. You're going to have multiple generations of people, right? So if this becomes the family tenant, we cast Druid's Grove here every day. That's the thing our family does. And you pass that down to your children. And you can do this for thousands of years and just grow the Druid Bastion by making this a tradition within a family lineage.
I mean, one thing that kind of speaks to me about is that when you're looking at druids compared to other classes, druids probably existed before clerics. They for sure existed before wizards. So if this is a spell that druids have known the whole time or have known for a long time, likely the world is dotted with more of these than any kind of permanent cleric spell or permanent wizard spell. These are things that, you know, as nature kind of primal magic, these are the sorts of things or the sort of spell that's likely to be dotted around the world in greater amounts than clerics, perhaps, because like the worship of the gods seems like it must follow later than just kind of general nature worship, although
it's a little more formal. Nature magic comes from the land and just being there, right?
Yeah.
You have to recognize the gods. You have to realize what they want, how to worship them, quote unquote, correctly, the way that gods want to be worshipped. They have to ordain you as a cleric. Once a cleric, always a cleric. Hello, my name is Dane. I think what we're finding out here, Benjamin, is that druids would rule the world.
If
they're ancient enough, they would just always be there. These wouldn't be dotting the land. This would be the land.
I hadn't really come anywhere close to that in the notes, but as I'm thinking it through, and especially thinking like, well, for wizards, you need writing, you need libraries, you need
incense,
like schools, you need institutions,
component pouches.
But for druids, there's nothing like that. So like druids, kind of in the life cycle of a setting, druids are probably the first full spellcasters to show up. And by hundreds or thousands of years, or maybe tens of thousands of years.
The only thing preventing them from taking over the world is probably their wisdom score. they've got the wisdom not to do this, right? They've got the altruistic nature of people connected to nature, nature, to not be complete overlords of the natural world. I don't know. I feel like they have it within their power over thousands of years to just completely dominate the land with this spell, but they can't. Not that they can't, that they don't, because they know it's bad. It's evil. It's let nature do nature, right?
Yeah. Well, and the only other explanation I think you could have is one that you brought up, Dane, in previous episodes, which is that when you read the D&D books, you're thinking that these spells exist kind of out of time, that like if they exist in the books, then they've always existed since the classes that can cast them existed. So if you don't like this idea or don't want to run with this idea that the world is just dotted with druids groves because they were here first and they would do that, then another way you could think of it is that this was a late stage addition to their spell list.
A recently developed tool that the druids have created in response to civilization. They see that, you know, these kingdoms are becoming too warlike, and they're like, right, we got to do something about this. We're going to have four permanent trees that just can wreck house for 24 hours. We're going to have this thick ass fog going through,
tangled, a whole lot of wind.
We're going to have a wind wall. We're going to have gusts of wind. Those are the two kinds of wind.
There'll be spikes.
It's going to be spikes. There's going to be tangles.
So to me,
you're going to love it.
Going back to my inner cult leader.
Tap into it, man. Cult of the Benjamin.
When I tap into my inner cult leader, I think, of course, everyone sees the spell and they think this is a great way to make a community safe from outsiders. The cult leader in me says it's also a great way to make sure that people in your community cannot leave easily or safely.
You disgust me.
Well, yeah, I mean, as soon as I said or safely, I was a little disgusted with myself. But
that's your saving grace, buddy. You're still human.
So yes, the spell, it works really well for keeping people out, but just as well, you can picture a situation in which a druid has made a really idyllic place for people to live, gotten people there, and then surrounded in druid's groves that's very difficult to leave. And one interesting element of the spell that's not super clear is that it says that
when you cast the spell, you can specify creatures as friends who are immune to the effects. That's vague as hell.
Right. So it doesn't tell you how you specify them. Like, it doesn't say, do I have to name Dane is allowed to go out, or can I say any podcast co-host of mine can go out, or any podcast co-host of mine that is particularly deferential to me can go out, because I can.
They must be deferential,
right? Yeah, exactly. So, like, do I want Dane to always be able to leave and just do so? Do I name him, or do I say that he also has to be my podcast host, co-host, and deferential to me? Because that's what I'd want. You know, is for it to be easy for him to leave as long as he's deferential to me. And so
as soon as he's not, oh boy,
as soon as he's not, trouble. Those four trees are going to be up on him.
Just right. Just bat me out of the park. Home run after home run. Well, right. So like
hold on a sec, Dane, before I limit this to exclusively kind of a threat to Dane.
A veiled threat, yeah.
A veiled threat to Dane. To tie it into how this would work in the game is that if you could say things like, any creature that worships me can easily come and go.
So as soon as somebody who
stops worshiping you, then it becomes difficult for them, as it becomes as difficult for them to enter as it does for them to leave.
Damn, this ground's getting spiky. Is this ground getting spiky for anyone else?
Has it always been this spike?
Am I taking 1d4 damage per step? Jesus Christ. I don't like it. That tree's looking at me sideways. Hey, Benjamin, you hear about this new RPG match?
Boy, have I.
Yeah, they're sponsoring the show this week, so you better have. It's the TTRPG matching service that allows you to browse and connect with other tabletop folks who like to play like you do, like even you do.
Huh. So you're saying if I wanted to find someone to play a new game with?
Yeah, RPG match.
If I wanted to meet someone who will actually show up on time?
Yeah, you just go to RPG match.
What if I want to play with people as excited about world building as I am?
Well, Benjamin, and we all know you're so passionate about world building, I would go to RPG match. Now, if they want a super political campaign that's mostly social machinations, they should probably go to RPG match and find you.
Compliment accepted.
When you go to RPG match, they ask important questions like what your safety tools are, what you think about character death, and different stylistic things so that you're guaranteed to have a good fit before you sit down at the table or your virtual tabletop, the VTT.
RPG Match is also partnering with major publishers, from Chaosium to Free League to Paizo and more, to allow you to unlock special badges.
RPG Match is more than just a matching service, Benjamin. Okay, I can hear it in your voice that you think that they're just a matching service, but they're not.
Guilty.
They're building an online community from the ground up. That's hard to do. They've got tabletop gamers in mind. And are you ready for the best part, Benjamin?
Lay it on me.
It's free.
All of it.
Every part. Just for the listeners, Benjamin just took the palm and he hit it on his forehead like, oh, why didn't I think of that?
Last season on Druid's Grove.
After what you did, who knows what will happen?
This could be our last chance at happiness.
The vines of romance became too tangled.
But I thought you said that message was for me.
I cast something to the wrong person, okay?
And the thorns of love grew too sharp.
I can't talk to you like this.
It was only one health potion, come on!
But this season is going to blow you away.
But don't you know I love you?
What?
Can four awakened tree spirits protect a druid's heart?
Ugh, I know we've been together for 200 years, but I'm just not ready to make that kind of commitment.
Or will those feelings wither like fruit on the vine?
Oh, don't you understand? I can't face him now. I can never go back.
It's the season premiere you've been waiting for. Only in the DG.
I brought up water breathing earlier. We talked about water breathing earlier. I think just in terms of practicality, archipelagos of islands would be the easiest to turn into a druid domain. What? Because the islands you could totally cover pretty quick. Not a lot of baseball diamonds on those islands, right? And then
the perimeter of the island, at least, which is kind of what you need.
Yeah. And then with water breathing, you don't even really need to cast it underwater. You just have the ability to be underwater and do your business down there, cast your plant growths, make a bunch of seaweeds, impassable seaweed trenches, you know, things like that. So I feel like we could get a real island vibe going with these cults real easy.
It would be very easy. And the other thing is that like some of the verbiage around Druid Grove says on land.
Oh, but, interesting. Yeah.
But there are low level spells and even cantrips that let you mold earth.
Oh, sure.
So it'd be very easy to just raise the beaches up, cast Druid Grove, and then lower the beaches back down again.
So it's just floating on the water.
So, yeah, exactly. So there's lots of ways to like kind of, I think,
unless lowering the land dispels the magic because it's no longer on land.
Well,
an argument.
It's all
to be
down
made.
To yeah. I mean, it's all down to DM interpretation.
It's semantics. But it's a lot of fun.
I would allow the reach around.
I love that they used a cube for this because in the solid fog, in the grasping undergrowth, they say specifically a 5-foot square. So I'm just thinking, like, I want that square. And it's just this little 5-foot square, a literal cube of fog in the middle of your grove. I like thinking about, like, it's Minecraft.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Druid yeah, Grove true. Is Minecraft.
I guess that's true. In any spell with a cube kind of setting, but this one in particular, yes,
it's you just do a end up square having of yeah. spikes and weeds and grasping vines. Anyway, I think water-faring druid archipelago colonies, you could get those spun up a lot faster than a whole mountain or under mountain.
What? Okay, so once again, why would you do a mountain though? Unless you're building a ski resort.
Because I like mountains.
Okay. Because like a valley is what you would do, right? Because that are the like green, verdant
but
places.
I like
a mountain is like,
but I like mountains.
Barren.
Okay. I like mountains.
I guess what I'm saying, listeners, is that Dane is not a very effective cult leader. And I feel like he could learn a lot if he would just start paying attention when I talk.
What?
Let's pivot. The last of the four bullet points about things you can do is it's fog, it's growth or undergrowth, I guess. And then there's the awakened trees. And then the last one is one of these three like other effects. And two of those effects are gust of wind or wind wall. I think both of them are two places inside the area you can choose.
Can we just piece apart what a location is? Within 90 feet, it's just a location. Like, what does that mean that there's a gust of wind in this location? Isn't wind amorphous?
It is weird because also each of those spells lists a space or a kind of dimension that they exist in. And so it's like, does that have to exist completely within inside the Druid's Grove? Or if I pick the furthest edge of the Druid's Grove, does it then kind of persist outside of it? I don't know. That's not something D&D is great at. Although I think it's a strength of D&D that it's not great at, because it would be kind of super obnoxious if it were too specific. But anyway, I bring this up to say that between that fourth effect of being able to add gust of wind or wind wall, you'd really be able to lean into any wind-based technology, which I guess is exclusively windmills. But you'd allow those to work constantly. Windmills, according to Wikipedia that I looked up 30 minutes ago, in the kind of their earliest incarnations were used to grind grains and dredge up water or rather kind of move water around. But in a sufficiently advanced society, they could also be used to provide reliable electricity.
Which is almost antithetical to a druid's worldview. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it has to be, especially if you've got some kind of, you know, people create all kinds of settings for D&D. And I think a kind of science fantasy, I love science fantasy settings myself. And I think you can imagine that this does allow druids to position themselves as kind of a clean alternative to kind of coal burning or industrial societies if they've got windmills that can produce electricity. Another, though, kind of interesting idea apart from that kind of infrastructural benefit is that if you cast Druid Grove near a river or any other body of water, I suppose, you could use that gust of wind, because gust of wind is actually quite long. It's, let's see, it's 60 feet long and 10 feet wide. So you easily can meet or exceed the distance of the Druid's Grove itself with two of those placed strategically. You could create fast lanes of travel for ships. Like if we're talking about a river, you could easily make it, like if the river is 20 feet wide or more, then you could make the wind traveling one way on one side of the river, the other way on the other, and then ships with sails would be able to travel. I don't know enough about ship travel to be certain about this, but perhaps even against current if the wind is strong enough pushing against.
Yeah, you just make a kind of a skimmer. So the current doesn't even matter, right? You're just riding on top of the water.
Yeah.
There, you could also do this on land for land vehicles. I remember in Avatar in the desert, they had the windbender, or sorry, the sandbenders would push their skiffs along using the sand. But you could do this with sail-based land vehicles, or in the snow. You could push them like on mountains, like a mountain, maybe even mountains.
Wow.
Snowy mountains. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Ignoring mountains for one moment. I do think that's a really fun idea.
Why would we do that? Kind
of spiral sail land-based ship, land-based. Ooh, kind of like,
yeah.
I mean, I do think that opens up some really fun ideas that don't make sense in a setting without the spell. But when you've got the spell, and when you've got like kind of like we talked about, if druids are the very first class that's ever existed, then there are a lot of druid groves placed down over the world. And you can imagine that some of those might have been placed down to get people easily from one region of the world to another.
Have you heard of solar punk? Solar punk as a genre?
Exactly. That's kind of what I'm getting at. Like, you can imagine that then there are these sort of land-based ships that operate based on like the sails are spinning from the wind, and that's making the wheels turn, and they're moving quickly. So you can, I think it makes sense then that there are these super ancient kind of wind roads, that it's not any faster if you're riding a horse and a wagon, but if you're using kind of a wind ship, then you cross super fast.
So this solar punk ancient civilization of druids with like green technologies that are a lot of wind-based stuff, and like these kind of advanced forms based on druidic ideals.
Yeah, I mean, it really, this concept makes me, especially like I had not considered before recording this episode, that if you're looking at D&D classes from a temporal aspect, druids probably precede a lot of spellcasting classes. But now that I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking about how that being true would produce some technologies faster than others, such as like a wind-based land ship or something.
Well, and then you get, if that civilization falls for whatever reason, then if you're post the druidic supremacy, not supremacy, but the druidic age, then there are these like slipstreams on land that you have to navigate. And now they may have used them as roads previously, but now you have a wind river, and you have to figure out, how am I going to get past this crazy wind river that's going one way on one side, the opposite way on the other side? Yeah. We can't get through this easily. Like, we need to go over it somehow. But if we get caught, then we're just slipped away.
But I think, yes, so that's one thing. And then the other thing is the implication of, why would people ever have moved on from the protection of druids to clerics, to wizards, to anyone else?
Yeah.
And so you can really build a kind of rich history out of, druids were able to lend all of these things to emerging societies. So then why did emerging societies move past or beyond druids? So there's a lot of kind of inherent conflict.
Story hooks, yeah.
Yeah, story hooks, conflict, backstory, and like druids were making life easier for people. So why did they decide that wasn't enough, and that they should worship gods, or that they should develop writing and libraries and institutions that would allow them to progress beyond that?
Because they were fools, Benjamin, and they fell from the path. Druids can be assholes too. Yeah,
I think every setting to some extent implies a set of ethics or morals. And I do think, some of it could be that people are fools and they make things more complicated than they need to be. Although I think another thing could be, maybe these druids became authoritarian, or they were like cult leaders. And so it was very much like,
it became that way. Sure.
So because you can decide creatures that aren't affected by any of the things, you could also kind of do it in reverse, where you could make it so that these wind streams don't affect your enemies.
Right. They can't utilize your resources.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could make it so that these wind roads that your wind ships drive on are not available to your enemies. And that's, I had not considered that before, but.
And they're guarded by four giant trees.
And they're guarded by four giant trees. So that if you even come into the area to like try to use a wind ship or, and I mean, well, your wind ship wouldn't be affected. I don't know. It's very, that's a little confusing to think about, but.
There's a lot going on there. Can we talk about the trees for a minute? Can we talk about the trees?
Let's talk about the trees because Dane outfoxed me, which is funny because his last name is Fox McGraw.
It is very foxy. It's very funny.
Is it foxy or is it funny? Not very foxy, but I was outfoxed.
It occurs to me that if you've got four awakened trees that can do your every command, you've got essentially four laborers that can work for 24 hours at a time just as the vanilla spell. Now, if you've got this permanently, then you've got four laborers who can work constantly forever.
Or the life cycle of a tree, which... I think before when we talked about awakening, the spell awakening, we talked about the life cycle of like redwood trees.
Right. Hundreds of years. Sure.
Hundreds of years. And so if you cast the spell for every day for a year, you've got redwood trees that can do whatever you tell them to do for hundreds of years.
It's not always going to be redwood trees. Redwood trees don't grow everywhere, but yes. And You've got these trees working for you. They're doing the things that you're telling them to do. Something else occurs to me, Benjamin. It says that they are affected by, as if by the awakened spell. So they have an intelligence of 10 for 24 hours. You are essentially bringing four souls into this world and then snuffing them out. Am I right?
Wait, does it say that they were affected by the awakened spell?
You animate up to four trees in the area, causing them to uproot themselves from the ground. These trees have the same statistics as an awakened tree.
Wait, hold on a sec. Oh, an awakened tree, I just looked up the stat block, does have an intelligence of 10.
It does, yes.
And it knows and apparently can speak
one
language known by its creator.
Yes. So you've created four lives that are here for 24 hours and then gone. That's kind of fucked up.
It is kind of messed up, but it is interesting, like a kind of interesting philosophical point. It's like, is that okay if by the end of 365 days, you create a kind of permanent
They're trapped. Being? They can't leave this 90-foot space. This sentient, awakened creature is trapped in a baseball diamond to play baseball forever.
I guess my counterpoint to that, Dane, is that we are all trapped on planet Earth.
Oh my God, you're right.
Right? So like everybody's trapped somewhere. Like my parents decided that it was okay to trap me on
Ohio.
Whatever. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, whatever square footage the planet is, probably a lot.
Okay. You tell me the difference between living on the planet Earth and living in a 90-foot square. And if there's no difference to you, that's fine. But obviously your brain works different.
Well, I think if the choice is to exist or not to exist, you always choose, I would rather exist in whatever the context of my existence is.
What's
right?
the longest you've spent in an airport?
Dane, if I never left my house again, I would be a very happy man.
Okay, well,
and I promise to you that
you're a little overwhelmed right now by life. So, you know, I think you're
promise
maybe
you
talking...
that I live in a house that's smaller than a baseball diamond.
In any case, you can get a lot done in 24 hours, even with the vanilla spell not permanently cast. You can get a lot done in 24 hours if you've got four beings working for you the entire time.
Yeah, I do think that this concept is also where the real meat of how this spell could affect a setting cracks open, because if a druid or singular or druids plural have been collaborating to create a community that's surrounded by druids groves, then you've got a ton of creatures there that are kind of essentially golems. They're kind of mindless automatons who will do what you tell them to do. Well,
not,
I mean, that's
not mindless.
That's super tricky because they've got an intelligence score of 10, but they also will do whatever. And they can speak, but they will do whatever you tell them to do. So they're kind of programmable. You know, they're kind of programmable robots.
They're commandable. They're commandable.
I guess it's more, yes, maybe more like, well, we're getting into kind of a theory of consciousness issue here.
Yeah, but we are.
But the point is, you can command them to do things. And so if you need things like if you have cast plant growth over everything and you just need farmers, then you could create a kind of maybe a society that needs no labor by just having all of these awakened trees do farming for you, do textiles for you, you know, whatever else, depending on how littered the region is with the spell. It kind of even more goes into that concept of druids as community leaders and cult leaders, because now there's this huge, not huge, but there's a significant labor force that kind of demands nothing.
And if you need it to keep going indefinitely, then that's where the family piece comes in, right? Because once you pass away, then this goes away. Who are they answering to once you've died?
That's a good point. Actually, the spell does not specify. I think what you could say is, since they obey verbal commands, you can say, from now on, I want you to accept so-and-so's commands as if they were commands from me.
Now that opens up another can of entanglement, because what's stopping the head druid from saying, you all must have your trees pledge their fealty to me?
Well, not just that, it also opens up the opportunity for bureaucracy where druids can create all these awakened trees and then like appoint different ministers to different trees and saying like, okay, so my commands are equal to their commands, but like this is the farming ministry and then this is the like this is the ministry of metalsmithing or whatever else, and have all that broken up. Regardless, the point is that's a huge, not super huge, but it is a base of
significant
of labor that all they need is sunshine, soil, and water,
right.
And they're good to keep moving.
Wild,
yeah,
wild stuff.
It always sounds like you're doing Dana Carvey doing an old nighttime talk show host when you
Johnny
say
Carson.
Wild, wild stuff. Johnny Carson.
Johnny
wild,
Carson.
Wild, wild stuff. It is, listeners, it is 10 past 10 as we record this. And I think given Dane and I's age, we probably are both quite past our bedtimes at this
I'm
point.
I'm quite past my bedtime.
Okay.
I'm a sweepy, weepy little weeping willow.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you again after your next long rest.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Dispel Magic. If this has inspired any ideas for your game, or you have another take on today's topic, please let us know on Twitter, @DispelMagicPod. You can find Benjamin @SterlingVerman and Dane @DaneInDanger. Thank you to Slim Mittens for our cover art, produced by Benjamin Huffman, produced and edited by Dane Fox McGraw.
Gary Busey's in Rookie of the Year. Did you know that?
Is that fucking true? Holy shit.
Because I remember Daniel Stern from from Home Alone and City Slickers, because he was the like the wild baseball player guy, like chewed tobacco and spit a bunch.
Okay, well, we need to stop this. This is all getting cut. That part is getting cut. So let's